Chapter 18. Price Go Up. Bernie didn't like coming to China, so he said. Though president of his own company, he was at his best a salesman. His time was better spent meeting with customers in the United States. Visiting with a prospect for a couple of days, Bernie explained, he could close a deal that would keep King Chemical busy for many weeks. The trips to China were an interruption, but they were unavoidable. This time, Bernie was coming in to solve problems that we were having with pricing. The factory had been attempting to push through a number of last-minute price increases, and the problem was so serious that it threatened the viability of the entire business. In the manufacturer's conference room, Bernie placed a large file case on the oval-shaped table. He dropped a pile of papers onto the desk and took some sheets from the top. It was a set of financials prepared by his company's accountant. "First, I want her to see this," he said, turning the papers so that they faced Sister. "I want her to see how much money we've lost so far." He pushed the financials across the table, pointing to a figure at the bottom of one page that was in parentheses. Bernie and his partners had apparently suffered losses of nearly $2 million. Bernie was quick to point out that while the loss was substantial, he still had faith in the business. Johnson Carter was about to turn a corner, and he was speaking with a growing number of new large accounts. These were major retailers, he said, and they were all very excited about doing business with his company. But if Johnson Carter could not catch these orders because of pricing problems, then the orders could not be sent to King Chemical. "We can make so much money together," he said, "but first we have to understand each other. We have to recognize that what affects one company affects the other." Bernie went on to describe some of the companies he was speaking with. They included Walmart, Colgate-Palmolive, several drugstore chains, and all of the top dollar store companies in the United States. "I knew that this was really happening because I was occasionally asked to speak with company representatives on behalf of Johnson Carter." "Within 2 years," Bernie said, "we will be producing at volumes that'll rival the largest manufacturers of health and beauty care products in the world." With the way things were going, it did seem possible. Sister nodded as Bernie spoke. While she appeared to agree with him, she was distracted. She glanced over at the financials, and just as Bernie finished his small speech, she reached out and touched the pages. She could not have understood the words there, nor did she have the financial training to understand the figures. The financials were printed on crisp, white stock paper, and what seemed to attract her was the general look of the documents. Though the work was undoubtedly from a template, probably done with accounting software, it was professional. King Chemical didn't keep accurate records that might alert managers, employees, or local government officials about how profitable their business was. The company was doing millions of dollars worth of volume, but its accounting was still either scratched off in pencil or kept in Sister's head. Bernie's talk had been a prelude, a philosophical setup for a discussion that he wanted to have about pricing. Specifically, he was troubled by how the factory moved to raise prices only after he had negotiated Johnson Carter pricing with its customers. It took several months for Bernie to secure an order with a major retailer. Styles and quantities had to be determined, and labels were often custom-made. In some cases, customers wanted formulations adjusted. Decisions were made by committee, and prices were always agreed to in advance of any green light for a production run. Bernie was sure to confirm prices with the factory before confirming his own pricing with his customers. But then right after Johnson Carter received its order from the retailer, often just days before he planned to wire transfer funds to China, the factory would notify Bernie of a slight price increase. Because large retailers made decisions by committee, it was next to impossible to make any changes once an order had been firmed up. Retailers expected that commitments would be honored, so Johnson Carter was not likely to go back to the retailer just a week or two after all of the paperwork had been signed and risk upsetting the business relationship. Of course, Sister denied that she was dealing in tactics. She claimed that they had no choice. "Price go up," she said, sounding urgent. It was one of the few phrases that she took the time to learn how to say in English, and she repeated it often. Bernie said that he could appreciate the claim about rising prices, but how could the factory give notice of a price increase only after Johnson Carter had confirmed pricing with King Chemical and initiated the order with the retailer? Increasing prices at the last moment was about moving profit margin from the importer to the manufacturer, and Bernie was not buying Sister's excuses in part because he had been the victim of 11th-hour attempts rather often. Every time Johnson Carter placed a particularly large order, the factory made the same move. It waited until just after the orders were secured, and only then did it announce the increase. Bernie was frustrated in trying to fix the pricing problem. He had a number of substantial orders that could not be processed because of the last-minute price move. He said that he would not go back to the retailer to ask for a price increase, and he could not suffer the losses himself. After a long day of negotiations at King Chemical, Bernie promised that it would be the end of the business relationship. He gave the standard line that Americans give when jerked around. "Don't they understand if they screw me like this, I'm never coming back?" Threats were of no use in our case. The factory had managed to increase prices on a number of items on Bernie's last visit, and he had similarly complained. He had raised his voice then and threatened that he would never return. Not only did he come back, but he brought even more orders with him this time. What frustrated Bernie was that he had counted on a certain profit margin, but King Chemical had managed to cut right into that expected income. Bernie had done this by going out and developing business. Having done this, he was now being told that his share would be diminished. In certain parts of China, there were fishermen who trained birds to catch fish. They tied the necks of the cormorant, a bird which looked a bit like a pelican, with a piece of string so that it could not swallow the fish that it caught from the river. Just as soon as the bird had a fish in its bill, the fisherman yanked it back with a rope attached to its foot. These fishermen could be seen in action on the Li River near the town of Yangshuo. What struck me most about the thing when I saw it was the bird's incredible optimism. It didn't realize that it was a sucker, and no matter how many times it was sent out into the water, this gullible bird had its quarry taken away. Watching King Chemical's last-minute pricing tactics, I came to understand. Johnson Carter was the bird. The factory was the fisherman. Bernie flew around the United States and signed up new clients, customers who would enable him to send millions of dollars worth of business to China. He created a margin for himself, and just as soon as he was about to enjoy the fruits of his labor, the factory came and took them away. Well, as much as it could manage anyway. The fisherman, of course, allowed the bird to eat some of what it caught, typically just the smallest fish that passed through its constricted neck, because the bird had to survive in order to keep catching fish. In a similar way, King Chemical did not take away so much of Johnson Carter's margin that the importer was washed out of the game. The factory had to know just how much it needed to give away to capture the business and how much it could take back through short-term maneuvering. The phenomenon of last-minute price increases was not a new one. Chinese manufacturers have actually been at it for quite some time. One of the first journalists to enter China following Chairman Mao's revolution was an Australian newspaper woman named Lisa Hobbs. She arrived in 1965, and among other places spent a good deal of time at the Canton Fair. In her book, I Saw Red China, she described what the Chinese government did to importers in those days. Typical of the way in which business is conducted is the fact that on April 14, one day before the Canton Fair opened, the Chinese government sent telegrams to every foreign buyer in the world with whom they did business and announced a flat price increase of 20% on all product over last year's price. There was little that Bernie could do, really. Long disagreements over price increases led only to production delays, which affected Johnson Carter more than King Chemical. King Chemical didn't much care whether it delivered the goods in March or in May. Like many other Chinese manufacturers, the company had access to cheap capital, and it also had less need to get any particular deal done. Johnson Carter was like most other American firms. Cash flow was tight, and Bernie was under a great deal of pressure to make his company profitable. There were short-term financial needs, and then the retailers all placed additional pressure on Johnson Carter. Just like many importers did, Bernie realized that it was better to get some revenue in the door than to lose business. Other importers were in the same situation, which was why short-term pricing schemes of this nature were played throughout South China. Factories that raised prices at the last moment never admitted to running a gambit, just as they would never claim that the issue was about wanting to earn more. Manufacturers insisted they earned no profit, even though it was obvious that they were expanding rapidly. When they went for a price increase, they blamed impassive market forces over which they had no control. "Price go up," was the resounding chorus heard across the manufacturing sector, and factory owners said it was out of their control, that it had to do with the cost of raw materials. The problem with the argument was that commodity prices moved down as well as up, but this was not the picture that these manufacturers painted. Whenever commodity prices rose sharply, they cried, "Price go up." When prices slackened, though, they fell silent. and the sudden commodity price increases were not nearly as urgent as some made them seem. Many of the manufacturers kept a stock of key raw materials, meaning that they had supply from when prices were lower. This did not prevent them from trying to gain more profit on the news of a price increase on raw materials. If they did not have their own private stockpiles, manufacturers often held contracts that guaranteed a certain price for a period of time. "The price of plastic has gone up $200," Sister said. Bernie asked how much the factory was paying on a per-ton basis, but Sister would not say. Chinese manufacturers did not like to provide detailed market information, though they were glad to announce the increased amounts. They would not indicate, for example, what the price had been or what the new price was at that very moment. They would hint only at a change. They would only say, "Price go up." It was like asking someone for the price of unleaded gasoline and being told that it had gone up 25 cents. The news of an increase was not useful without the rest of the information. Bernie wanted to be put in touch with suppliers who sold key raw materials to the factory. He wanted to learn about pricing in general, and he wanted to track trends. All he was asking for was basic market information. King Chemical refused to make any related introductions, and they refused to help Johnson Carter figure out how much or in what way prices were actually moving. When I managed to find some market data from a company that tracked commodity trends, the factory insisted that the figures provided did not apply in their case. Sister did not offer to look over the information that we had, but she was happy to repeat, "Price go up." On one level, you couldn't blame the factory owners. Their own sub-suppliers were subjecting them to similar price games, and their own domestic contracts were not always honored. Westerners were really just being pulled willy-nilly into a game that went on in the local market. Still, factory owners took advantage where they could. On one project I was involved with, we were making precision component parts. The rising price of copper posed a challenge. The market price for the metal was said to have doubled, and the factory used this piece of news to double its price to my client. It sounded logical enough, except that the manufacturer had conveniently forgotten that the metal was just a part of the total cost. Copper metal made up maybe 50% of the total price that we paid. By doubling its price to us from $2.50 to $5 on the one item, the factory covered the increasing cost of copper from $1.25 to $2.50, but then it also watched its profit margin rise. Assuming a 20% margin, it went from earning 50 cents to $1. Chinese manufacturers were good at finding the opportunity in a crisis, and while the pinch from rising material costs was genuine, these manufacturers figured, why let a good excuse go to waste? They liked to play thick, and they pretended not to understand their own businesses. When a textile importer asked for better buttons for his China-manufactured shirts, the factory mentioned that it had buttons that cost 5 cents each. When the invoice was printed, the new price reflected a nickel increase for each button. The factory had forgot to subtract the cost of the older, cheaper buttons that had been replaced, though. The importer who told me this story said that when the fact was pointed out, his supplier simply went, "Huh?" as if he had no clue what was being suggested. Chinese factory owners looked for small excuses as a way of gaining minor advantage. However, when there were real substantive changes in the marketplace, these same factories found the will to keep their prices firm. The United States had been pressuring China to appreciate its currency, and China finally announced in 2004 that it would revise the currency peg, under which the U.S. dollar equaled 8.26 renminbi. In connection with the revision, the U.S. dollar would be devalued by about 3% against the renminbi. Every factory that I was working with then pointed to the major news announcement and sent out a notice saying that their prices would be increased by 3%. You had to believe them that it was necessary. It was in the news after all. In this way, they got a small gain out of the importer's bottom line. Oddly enough, though, when the Chinese currency was devalued by a much greater percentage, 10%, and then even more, the very same manufacturers said that we should not worry about the impact of further changes. When importers were ready to bolt, manufacturers cried, "Don't go anywhere. We'll hold prices steady." Chinese suppliers could work magic when it came to keeping their prices cost competitive, and yet they had a strong affinity for the small nibble. It was these tiny bites that frustrated importers more than anything. Made in China was billed as a deflationary force for the American economy. At least this was the claim that many economists made. Chinese manufacturers were keeping our cost of living down by offering to make products for less. Sitting in pricing negotiations with Chinese manufacturers, you got a slightly different idea of who was doing the work to hold down prices. Manufacturers might have offered low prices as an incentive to bring in big pieces of business, but over time, they worked on ratcheting up their prices, and they were extremely savvy about how they did it. If there was anyone who was really working to keep costs down for the American consumer, it was the fellow who was arguing with the manufacturer that he needed prices to be held low. If there was any real deflationary hero, it was not the manufacturer, but the importer. One of the reasons that prices were on the rise had to do with how importers were losing at the negotiation table. One of the reasons that this was happening was because manufacturers played the game better. They were more formidable negotiators. I sat with Bernie in a negotiation as he tried to work out pricing with the factory. He had one retailer that wanted prices for some new bottles that were about double the size of some existing Johnson Carter products. The factory prepared a quote for these larger bottles that came as a surprise to Bernie. On a bottle that was double the size, the factory quoted nearly triple the original price. It was the exact opposite of what every supermarket shopper already knew, that as package size increased, so did the value. "I can't take these prices to my customers," Bernie said. "We are doing our very best," Sister said. "But how do you explain these prices?" Bernie shook his head, knowing that he would have to explain the logic to the buyer at a retail chain. Trying to make sense of the pricing scheme, he asked, "How much would it cost if instead of doubling the sizes of the bottles, we shrank them in half?" He wanted just to get a picture of Sister's methodology. She calculated the price and said that, for a bottle that was half the size, the price would remain the same as the original size. Bernie threw up his hands in frustration, looking as though he might walk out of the room. "How can it be the same price?" he asked. Bernie figured that maybe the issue might be volume. He said that production volumes were going to increase if he could get the pricing worked out. How would Johnson Carter's prices be affected with triple the volume of business? Sister said that such an increase would make no difference to her company whatsoever. "Ask her, what if we increased volume 10 times? "Pricing would be about the same," Sister said. "How can there be no difference? 10 times! Chinese factories were not in the habit of offering discounts for volume. Chinese raw materials were purchased at market rates that did not differ much based on volume, and the factory owner claimed to be producing at cost. Dropping the price suddenly, on the hope of slightly larger volume, would punch a hole in Sister's story about manufacturing goods for next to no profit. After days of back and forth, Bernie was frustrated. As he did every visit, he somehow thought that negotiations with King Chemical would go faster and more smoothly. Like other importers, he figured he would fly in, get his business done, and then quickly be on his way back home. Sister had a different idea. She was determined to keep everyone at the negotiating table for a much longer time and use some of her pricing games as a means of collecting information. When Bernie reacted angrily at one product pricing model and then less frustrated with another, it gave Sister a rather good idea of where Johnson Carter's margins were tight and where they enjoyed more profit. Chinese factory owners did well in negotiations despite language barriers. They relied more on emotion and on their instincts. Sister did not need English in order to conduct business. She could see just how well she was doing by looking at Bernie's expressive face. Bernie was an excellent salesman, but he fell victim to some of the more obvious manufacturer's tactics. When Sister suggested a price increase for one product type over another, she picked up on his visible panic. Prices were all over the place, in part because Sister was pressing different buttons, assessing Bernie's varied reactions. Factory owners conducted themselves in such a way that increased rather than minimized the frustration of the importer, which seemed strangely counterproductive. After all, it cost money to find and keep a customer. And yet importers who did business in China reported having the same experience. In other sectors, companies went out of their way to reward customers for remaining loyal. This was the logic behind every frequent flyer program. Rather than reward customers, factory owners punished them. It was as if these importers were participating in a reverse frequent flyer program. The longer an importer stayed with its supplier, the worse the deal became. Chinese manufacturers understood the benefit of offering enticements to get a business relationship going, often at extreme prejudice to initial profitability, but after some interval, the factory jeopardized goodwill in order to fund its return. Supplier relationships were almost never better than they were at the very beginning. Manufacturers intentionally degraded the quality of their product, and at the same time, they found small ways in which to ratchet up prices in the short term. Business relationships were supposed to improve over time, but these manufacturing relationships only got worse. At one point in pricing talks, on our fourth straight day, it seemed for a moment that Johnson Carter and King Chemical were close to agreeing on a number of key issues. Regarding one order, the manufacturer suggested that it would match price targets with an exception on only a few products. The next day, Sister came back and said that she could not do it. It was the timing that upset Bernie the most, and he was visibly angry. Sister remained calm and said that she understood. She thought that maybe it was time to consider dissolving the partnership altogether. "We can still be friends, of course," she said. Bernie could not believe that it was happening to him. It was one thing that prices were going up. Now the factory was suggesting that he leave and go to another supplier. It happened all the time in negotiations. At a critical point in the talks, the factory took the entire deal off the table. The news seemed to have been delivered to Bernie at precisely the most inopportune time, done in a way that would maximize his frustration. Sister had allowed Bernie to believe that progress was being made, and just as he was looking forward to concluding some parts of the negotiations, just as he was made to think things were on track, she delivered the sucker punch. South China manufacturers actually went out of their way to make an importer lose his cool. It was a tactic, a technique used in the negotiation. Professional interrogators did the same thing by placing a suspect under emotional pressure. It was the easiest way to know that information collected was to any extent reliable. Chinese had an idiom, Hun Shui Mo Yu. You muddied the waters first, and only then did you feel around for the fish. When an importer was clear-minded, it was easier for him to evade. When the importer was emotionally confused, it was easier to read his intentions. Unaware of what was being done to him, Bernie tried to put things back on track. He tried to convince Sister that she was short-sighted, that there was a better way to go about building a business between the two companies. "Why can't they just see the big picture?" he asked. "If they would just stick to our plan, we could build such a business." Working between the two groups, I could see their different perspectives. One major disconnect was time horizon. Bernie was thinking about the next several years. King Chemical, on the other hand, seemed focused on only the very next purchase order. Bernie's view was that the factory's short-term maneuverings were adversely affecting the long-term viability of the business partnership. While that may have been the case, it was not possible to say that the factory's approach was inferior. The factory's methods worked rather well, actually. If export manufacturing were like a game of football, then the factory was concentrating its efforts on short running plays. Chinese manufacturers were just trying to cover the 10 yards necessary to get to a first down. They were in it for the long haul, but their strategy was to get there by advancing in small, incremental distances. Bernie was frustrated, if only because he was thinking of a mutual strategy that was more dramatic in scope. He was looking for a grander, coordinated effort, one that had a long-range focus. He was interested in the poetic downfield pass. Claiming that the factory's methods were wrong would have been a mistake. The game could be won just as well, as King Chemical and indeed China itself was proving, by advancing down the field just a few yards at a time. China was an agrarian culture. For thousands of years, its farmers struggled through floods, droughts, and resulting famines. R. H. Tawney, a British historian, said that the life of the peasants was so precarious that it was lived as if they were up to their necks in water, that the slightest ripple would drown millions. Chinese farmers learned to make use of every inch of land while looking over their shoulders to pick up whatever new agricultural tricks they could in order to increase output. Mark Elvin, another historian, had a theory about why China never found its way to an industrial revolution. He suggested that farmers were good at finding small ways to increase efficiency through tinkering, and that success with short fixes dulled the impetus to build machines that could replace human labor. He called it the advantage of backwardness. What is surprising is how little has changed, even as the country has moved from agriculture to a focus in export manufacturing. Factory owners were just as focused on life at the margin. While they worried less about natural disasters, they behaved as though they were struggling just to get through the season. Certain behaviors that made little sense to an American importer, like last-minute price maneuvers and the clever manipulation of product quality, would have made more than enough sense to a 19th-century Chinese peasant or to someone who labored his life away 2,000 years ago. Some of the Chinese I have known recognized this cultural inclination as a shortcoming. On occasion, you would hear someone chiding another about being shumu cunguan, like the mouse that can see only 1 inch ahead of itself. What had kept the nation from creating its own industrial revolution was more than likely this enduring cultural trait, an endemic myopia. and knowing that they suffered from it was what led common folk to welcome the larger and more direct role that government played in their lives. In the microcosm of the factory, this myopia was keenly felt. Workers awaited instruction from above for even the smallest task assignment or objective. They seemed incapable, or perhaps unwilling, to coordinate among themselves, to see beyond their immediate circumstance. On the last day of our meetings with the factory, Bernie said that he was at the end of his rope. He did not want to change suppliers because of the time it would take to get an alternate up to speed. There was another reason that he had not wished to quit the relationship, and it had to do with how King Chemical knew too much about his business. The promise of continued orders had kept the factory from engaging in broader, unscrupulous acts. Once the manufacturing relationship ended, who knew how the factory might respond? King Chemical might approach Johnson Carter's largest customers and try to take them away, or maybe the factory would court some of the importer's competitors. Johnson Carter was growing fast enough that others would want to know how Bernie had done it. King Chemical had access to all aspects of the production line. It had the molds for bottles, as well as the label designs and the formulations. Since quitting the business would potentially create losses for King Chemical, they would likely be motivated to fill the income gap in some way. One thing Bernie worried about was that King Chemical could counterfeit his product line. If it did so, Johnson Carter would be in no position to learn about such activities once the relationship was dissolved. Johnson Carter leaving the relationship might change motivations in ways that we didn't even understand. Bernie said that he felt that the factory left him no choice. Quality was a continued question mark, and the pricing games were now too much to bear. We had to find another supplier, he said. A new supplier might be just as bad as the current one, which was another argument against leaving, but at this point, it was a chance worth taking. After our last pricing meeting with the factory, Bernie pulled me aside. He told me that it was time to chase down another opportunity. Be discreet. Make a few appointments. Show them the catalog. Bernie flew back to the United States, and I lined up a couple of initial meetings. The first manufacturer was a surprising disappointment. The factory owner told me that he knew all about Johnson Carter. Just looking at the catalog and seeing the company name, he knew that we were tied with King Chemical. He knew what we manufactured, and he added that he was friends with Sister as well. Like many other sectors, the health and beauty care industry was one that existed in a tight network. Some manufacturers in the industry were even related to one another. Others shared an educational background, having graduated from the same chemistry programs at the same universities in South China. Others shared a kinship that was based in part on membership in the Communist Party, and then some had suppliers in common. China's tight networks were a part of its advantage. They were one of the reasons that manufacturers were able to get things done so quickly. Factories were connected not just to sub-supplier networks, but also to other manufacturers. They shared information, contacts, and resources. But these networks were also a threat to importers. While it remained illegal for companies to collude, it was difficult to monitor such activities from abroad. Critics of globalization talk about how we have outsourced our values by allowing overseas firms to make products under conditions that Americans would never allow at home. One of the other things that we gave up with global trade would inevitably be the opportunity to prevent marketplace collusion. Sister found out about my visit almost immediately after the meeting was finished. It actually pleased her to know that I had been to see one of her competitors, and she seemed to enjoy that the news had traveled back to her so quickly and that we were having little luck in finding an alternate supplier. In pricing negotiations, Bernie had hinted on occasion that he might take his business elsewhere. When he made these veiled threats, Sister was inclined to soften her position in response. Now that Johnson Carter had actually taken action and the plan had backfired, our bluff was called, leaving Sister in an even better negotiating position. Another manufacturer might have become upset if its sole foreign customer was thinking of leaving, but Sister was, on the contrary, quite friendly toward me. She mentioned that she wanted to travel to the United States, and she asked me if I would get Bernie to write her an invitation letter, the sort that she could use to secure a visa from the U.S. consulate in South China. She wanted to visit relatives, and also, she said, she wanted to travel to Las Vegas. Specifically, she mentioned wanting to go to Cosmoprof, the world's largest health and beauty care trade show. She said that she was looking for ideas there, but the opportunity to visit would have opened up the chance for her company to exhibit as well. Obtaining a visa to visit the United States was a challenge for many mainland Chinese, and while they were certainly as welcome to visit and to immigrate as anyone else, the issue of travel to the United States was one that some importers considered. Visitor visas were not meant to be a competitive advantage in business, but they most certainly were for Chinese manufacturers. One of Bernie's concerns was that Sister would begin flying to the United States on a regular basis, that she would manage to meet with his own customers or possibly with his competitors. Once foreign nationals were granted their first visa to visit the United States, subsequent visas were typically easier to obtain. Bernie insisted that he would eventually get around to writing Sister an invitation letter, but he never would.